Did you like the finale of True Detective?
I don't want to bring down the energy here. I was very excited to watch the show. Like, I think one of the hardest things to do is land the plane, right? It had its highs, it had its lows, you know. I'm excited for another season of True Detective. Because they greenlit season 5. So, here we go.
So the most important thing is that the overall essence of the show is good enough to get you another season of it.
That's right. And I love seeing Jodie Foster. She's the best. So that was great.
Yeah. I would say that. I thought they did a good job. And then the finale was not great, in my opinion. So I'm just going to say that. But I'm excited like you for another show. But the big thing is I re-binged season 1. That is epic TV.
Yeah. Now, if you want to get me excited about a TV show, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, that show was awesome the whole way through, and they landed the plane in the best way possible. Maybe one of the best season finales I've seen in a decade. So let me bring the energy back up. Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Donald Glover, Maya Erskine, go check it out.
Is that why you react when I said I didn't like the finale? All right, we'll get back to business.
From ABM to PLG, from Medic to MedPick, the world of business is constantly evolving. We'll cover the who, what, where, when, why, and most importantly, how you get the transaction. I'm Matt Amundson, and he's Craig Rosenberg. Let's get started.
Welcome to the transaction.
Let's go.
I love that. Saying welcome to the transaction. You don't think that's gangster? I can't use that term, huh?
I mean, it's Brad Brady. I think it's great, but I'm not sure, you know, the transaction. This is a gangster podcast.
You're a marketer. That would be the thing we'd have under there. It's a gangster's fairy tale. Yeah. So the show's off to a great start as we had hoped, and we're having a lot of fun and learning a lot. And one of the things that, you know, you and I wanted to do, we wanted, like, you know, as much practical stories out there with new ideas. So it's like, often practical means to many people old school. It's like, we needed new ideas and new things that are happening. And part of that is like all the amazing things happen in tech. And so, you know, today's theme is to talk about tech. Mm-hmm. And we have, Scott Brinker, Chief MarTech. He's one of my heroes.
He's everyone's hero.
I know, man. And then a guy that I introduced you to.
Yeah.
An unforgettable analyst named Esteban Kolsky. And Sam can agree, our producer, like, Esteban, man, this guy he's an epic character. It's funny because years ago when I did Tippett, we had created Focus. I don't know if you remember that. And like, so my job was to go out and recruit independent analysts. And there was this whole, with social, there was this whole new thing with like independent analysts. I went to Paul Greenberg, who's like the godfather of CRM. And Brian Valmier is now at Salesforce. And they're like, oh, here's the list. And I met Esteban. And I'm like, I'll just tell you guys, this is really funny. The first time, so I had Esteban on a panel, and it was a killer panel. It was like, I had Paul Greenberg, I had Esteban, I had Mike Fawcett, I had, maybe Brent Leary was on. And these guys come on, and I asked the first question, and Esteban says, well, that was a stupid question. Yeah. It was amazing. I said, all right, I love this guy. But that's Esteban. You know, he says it the way it is. And part of the reason we brought the two guys on was that, you know, Scott had done a show on our previous podcast. It was amazing. And in the snippets, Esteban had a comment for each.
Yeah.
And so we said, well, why don't we bring you guys on together? And here, you know, the thing, I don't know if you noticed this in the show, but like, you know, Brinker's a learner too. And like, you know, so Esteban was sort of talking about Scott's topics and Scott was writing stuff down and learning. I thought that was fun for me to watch.
Yeah.
It is a technical conversation. And there is like broader sort of issues that Esteban brings up. But, you know, that's kind of why we wanted to have him on. He's not, you know, like if you asked him, you wouldn't say, well, I'm, you know, a contrarian on purpose. He actually has really strong feelings and has been looking at the market for a long time. So it's fun to have him come in and look at the things that, you know, like when we talk about, our first question is always like, what's surprising? What does the market think is right? Yeah. They should be thinking about it in a different way. Esteban's the epitome of that. So it's like this great combination.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the other thing too is just like, I'm not sure in the show we demystified AI. I think Esteban's main point is that if this is AI, then people are going to be disappointed. AI is going to be much bigger than that. I don't think Scott disagreed. I mean, what I would say to Esteban is like, well, we're just getting started. And so that's, you know, that was kind of the stuff. But I think the main thing for everyone is, like, as we think about the transaction and we want to have fun and we want to have interesting guests tell you about topics, I mean, Esteban is the epitome of what the market might think is happening and is right. There's another way to look at it. And it was fun to have him sort of engaging with Scott along the way.
Well, I totally agree. And the whole genesis for getting him on the show, you know, we posted clips of Scott. He had hot takes right there. Like, that is what we're looking for, right? Like, we want people to have not necessarily contrarian takes, but we want people who have unique takes and can back them up with real statistics and real facts and real experience. So, hey man, who knows? You see a clip from this show, you've got an opposite take, that might earn you a one-way ticket to being a guest on the transaction.
Pretty soon we'll have like 20 people on. It's like Brinker, Esteban, and this person. So, you know, I loved having these guys on the show. I have no doubt we'll have them on again as things continue to evolve, because they continue to evolve quickly. I was just thinking the other day, man, like how quickly things have innovated, and like, you know, you and I were, this wasn't sort of something we talked about in the show, but like, you know, the ability to research the customer. I was just thinking about that the other day, how many people were building apps that weren't AI driven to provide visibility into account information.
Sure.
They're about to get obsoleted.
Yeah.
Because AI's changed the game. That's incredible. I mean, that's years of building. You know, sales intelligence, the game changed overnight, and like in a good way, by the way. So people can be more prepared.
Yeah, for sure.
And you said, you know, you've said it before how you have this great sales leader and like his team, they come on with a hypothesis versus what keeps you awake at night. And, you know, I was just thinking about it. You know, I was thinking about it more in the context of the market and like how fast you have to move and how hard it is to stay in front of the game. And like, I've just been seeing a lot of really cool stuff coming out. I think in particular, by the way, in sales tech, MarTech's coming, right? Like Maria Pergolino today was saying, she's like, it's incredibly exciting to think about how AI is gonna affect everything we do in marketing.
Yeah.
But like right now, I think a lot of the sort of fun, cool stuff that at least I'm seeing has been on the sales side.
Yeah, we're building some pretty cool stuff at Census, and maybe at some point we'll break from the like host dynamic that we have to talk about some of the stuff that we're doing with data and AI to trigger campaigns. So we've got some fun stuff in our you know, kind of up our sleeves, getting ready to come out into the market pretty soon. Not from a product perspective, but purely from a go-to-market perspective, using a lot.
Right. Well, that's my
yeah.
But that's how you should think. In my opinion, when I think about you guys, it's from the go-to-market perspective. The learnings are across the life cycle visibility and the ability to make moves based on that across the entire life cycle. That's like the thing we've been talking about for a long time. To me, it's like it's big. It's like a go-to-market thing. But you're right. I mean, you guys are going to create a whole breakthrough sort of different type of movement as well. Not a show for Census, but like...
No, it's certainly not. And I'm not even talking about what we're doing from a product perspective. I'm talking about our own implementation of some of the stuff that Scott and Esteban are talking about to use it to trigger marketing campaigns. And then certainly, you know, I wasn't on the call with...
Got it. Yeah. That'd be fun.
I'm excited to start talking about how that makes its way into like my go-to-market, not necessarily like what our product does.
Got it. Yeah. No, that's key. Is like when we talk about wanting to give people ideas and examples, you have a ton of them.
Yeah.
And by the way, we need them. I like marketing, sales, CS, all this stuff. Everything's back on the table.
For sure.
And like we're gonna have new winners, and they're gonna be doing some really cool stuff. And so, and we've had a bunch of folks already on the show that are doing novel things. You will be one of them. You know what we should do on that one? We should have a different. We'll have, instead of a guest, we'll have a guest host, and you'll be the guest, and then we'll talk.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
What's up?
We'll
go deep.
All right,
I love it.
Let's go to the interview with Scott and Esteban. And again, like going forward, the interviews will be all of us together. In this use case, we pre-recorded this one, and it's going to be amazing. So enjoy. And again, welcome to the new show that Matt and I love and is produced by our boys Sam and Casey, The Transaction.
I'll be kind. I promised my therapist that I would be a nice person.
Well, there you go. So basically, everyone, here's the deal. Is Scott and I did our most viewed listened episode of all time. And so thank you, Scott. Esteban had some, in our LinkedIn shares, he had some pretty cool responses, or, you know, we might call it value adds to some of the takes we had. So we said, hey, let's go on and let's do a follow up and get some new perspectives on the MarTech, sales tech, revenue tech, Gen AI, you name it, topics with my good friend Esteban Kolsky. So just so everyone gets the layout here. So Scott Brinker, chief MarTech, like all of us have been following him for years, and just came out with, like, honestly, it was one of the best reports I've seen recently on the MarTech landscape. And that includes a lot of work that you've done over the years, but MarTech for 2024 was a great piece. And that was sort of, and everyone should, we're going to put in the show notes, everyone should read it. But Scott has been known for years as probably one of the best thinkers in MarTech. And that's why we call him Chief MarTech.
He basically started the whole movement.
I feel like I'm taking a lot of blame for that then.
No, that's not.
Well, actually, like, you get the good at the bad, dude.
I forget what you said on the last, Scott. You said something to the extent of, well, I'm kind of to blame for this with my, you know, with my big slot, you know, my
don't shoot the messenger. I mean, but yeah, okay.
No, there's no messenger. You created the message. There's no messenger here.
So Esteban Kolsky is a independent analyst with he's had a company, ThinkJar, for like what, 16-20 years?
Since I left Gardner, mostly. It was 2008, so 16 years, yeah.
Yeah, and he had a brief.
Wow, we've been doing this for the exact same amount of time. Started the Chief MarTech blog that year.
And one of us is liked and the other one is not.
Yeah, but don't pick on me. I mean, I've never been liked.
I love it. Spent some time at SAP. But really, I've known Esteban for these years as an independent analyst. And he's one of the guys that I, similar to Scott, guys that I read and listen to and respect the opinions of. And as you will find, Esteban and Scott are both have incredible knowledge. And this should lead to a great conversation.
And don't be shy. I mean, you're in the same club. Let's be honest here. I mean, I don't talk to you because, you know, I like the view behind you. You have really great opinions, and you're a very smart analyst, or whatever you want to call yourself. I think the word analyst is overused, but whatever you want to call yourself, you're a market pundit like no other for the markets that you shine in. To think of it, between the three of us, we're like, you know, the tenets of a CRM. We have sales, marketing, and customer service as our core backgrounds, you know.
That's
without a CRM, would it never happen? I mean, I'm just saying, that's a little side bit there.
You're going to leave it that. Yeah, and then, by the way, just a fun anecdote. The first time that I was doing a panel with Esteban in like 2009 or something, and like I get on and I ask him the first question, and so Esteban says, well, that's actually a really stupid question. Let me reframe that for you. It's brilliant.
But it was a good conversation afterwards.
You know? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I want to talk MarTech, go-to-market tech landscape. I want to start with the question that we always start with here. And like, you guys should jump in and feel, you know, let's just make this really conversational. We'll start with Esteban because Scott and I just did one, which is like, I want to figure out, like, can we surprise the audience? Like, what's something that the market thinks is happening, is right, or is, you know, best practice or whatever that might be? And they're actually wrong. And how should they be thinking about it? And what should they do about that?
Can we narrow that down a little bit? Are we talking about MarTech or in
general? Yeah, I think we should. Well, I mean, we could talk about, you know, some of the lead ins to this, I think, are around AI and Gen AI and the MarTech stack. So
let me give you two parts. The thing about marketing that the market thinks and they're wrong is like two things. Number one, they still today, what, 40 some years later, very few people in this world can define the value of marketing properly. You know, that's the number one thing. Everybody thinks they know what marketing is, but it's like high school. You know what? Everybody talks about it. Nobody knows how to do it. Everybody's doing it wrong anyways, right? So that's a big the best part, of the best way to define marketing. There's from CMOs, SVPs of marketing, down to like marketing practitioners, that are so narrowly focused on the very small piece of the pie that they don't see the big pie that marketing is. So that's the number one. To Gen AI and AI, the number one thing that the market thinks that they're wrong is like, you know, there's actual value to Gen AI by itself. Gen AI is, like I said in one of the comments to the postings you did on LinkedIn, Gen AI is a good interface, but that's all it is. There's no solution in Gen AI that really can be applied to anything. It's not AI. It's not AGI. The AGI will probably never exist. The AI will probably continue to evolve over the next 50, 60 years until we get somewhere half decent. But it's just one small step. This is like putting your shoes on before getting to like a 1,000-mile journey. It's not even like getting started with AI. But the nice thing is it brings AI into the conversation to a much broader audience that now can go, you know, understand a little better what potentially AI can do. The bad news is like, you know, man, did we screw the pooch on this one? You know, if we let people think that this is AI, did we screw the pooch on this one for expectations?
Scott, you have any reactions to either of his takes there?
Whew, well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot there. The whole thing about debating the value of marketing, how marketers think about that. I mean, boy, there's a lot you could cover in on that. I mean, I think part of the challenge here is you see failure cases on both ends of the spectrum. You see failure cases of basically people who are myopic, you know, like they've broken down marketing into so many of these sub silos. And you can make the case that MarTech has been one of the contributing factors to sort of, you know, this sort of, you know, hey, I have this tool that does this thing. And so I have someone who runs that thing, you know, and while there can be legitimate value in that piece, it's easy to start to lose the big picture of like, okay, that piece isn't in isolation. That is part of a, you know, larger orchestration. And I think it's absolutely fair to say, yeah, you probably have a lot of marketing organizations that larger orchestration of this is where the weakness is. That being said, I've seen the other failure case where, you know, folks come in who it's almost too high level of a view of marketing. And the reality is, I think what makes marketing so difficult right now is you've got like the historic role that marketing played and its responsibility around, I mean, you know, like the four P's and, you know, understanding the customer and, you know, how do we, you know, be the shepherd of a brand. And none of those things have gone away. Like those are still responsibilities of marketing. But then all this other stuff from an execution perspective, right? It's no longer the world where we just hand it over to the agency. The agency does some ads, does some media buys, you know, and we're done. There's so much operations level stuff here that now has gotten incorporated into the marketing department. And these are kind of two different ends of a spectrum of talents and creativity. And I think, yeah, we're still trying to synthesize those pieces together. Anyways, we can certainly go down that path. That's a super interesting discussion.
I think so. A couple of things that are telling, right? How many vendors are in your MarTech vendor landscape now? I lost track at 18,000, but you know, whatever. It's already enough a big number.
And let's say it's over 10,000, right? Yeah. At that point, so, anything above that, who cares, right?
So it will be at the very best disingenuous to think that with 10,000 plus vendors, there won't be 10,000 plus people that are very focusedly narrow, times whatever number of clients each one of them may have. And then you go to the millions of marketers, right? And I think that marketing as a tactical operation only fails. And I think that marketing as a strategic operation only fails. And I think that the best marketers that I've met in my life, CMO, SVP level, are the people that can both manage the manage up to the CEO and the board and manage down to the organization to deliver value at the 10,000 plus vendor level and to deliver value at the board level. That you gotta find somebody who understands the objectives of the board and understands the tactical aspects and tries to bring them together. And honestly, I met very few people that can do that.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. But so let me ask you this, I'm curious. the relationship between marketers and MarTech, you feel like, okay, one of the things that can be broken there is the fact that there are 10,000 plus MarTech solutions on the market. How do you feel about the relationship between marketers and agencies? Is that broken?
I think that agencies failed to adapt to the change in market fast enough. The agency model of charging every 15 minutes for doing something that continues to be the ruling model in agencies, it's wrong. And finding something to do in 15 minutes so you can deliver value versus focusing on the outcome regardless of the time that it takes, which is the model that most successful consultants and systems implementation and advisors use these days, would serve really well agencies if they were to make the change. But having said that, and having a brother that's in an agency himself and having the discussions, very heated discussions with him many, many times, that's not going to change because agencies don't find value. They think that the value they produce is not the outcome, but the actual execution, right? And this goes back to what I was saying before, tactical versus strategic. Hard, very, very hard to find strategic agencies, very easy to find tactical agencies. And when you go to tactical, then the 15-minute increment billing is basically king. So that's the problem. They fail to adapt to the market. The market is moving too fast to have an agency that builds a framework and delivers a framework consistently over 2 or 3 years. By the time they get to year three, they're already two or three iterations behind. And then they have to go and develop something else again from 6 months or a year that they're going to do for another 2 or 3 years and so forth. It's just the very narrow focus in like one specific product they do is a problem. I think it's broken. I think it's fixable, but not as an agency. I think it's fixable as an advisor, as a fractional person that comes in and manages a team to get to the thing. And I think it's fixable by the organizations reclaiming a lot of the ownership they give to the agencies over things that the agency has no place owning.
Okay. There's a lot there I agree with. I think the point I was trying to get at is, if you think there's a lot of MarTech companies in the world, the number of like agencies, service providers, SIs, advisors, consultants, really dwarfs the number of MarTech companies out there.
And well, so every guy who's ever worked in marketing and get laid off is going to go and put an agency, bring through three or four friends together, build a $1 to $2 million revenue stream, and call it an agency. So yeah, I agree with you there.
Yeah,
that doesn't mean they don't deliver value. Yeah. Like,
because I think we're in a world now where abundance of options for people is insane. And I don't think that's unique to MarTech now at this point.
We live in our core, in our core backgrounds. Right? My core background is customer service. I won't deny that. I build customer service for the last 30 plus years. We live in different worlds. Customer service, we narrowed it down to the very, very, very bare number of vendors we can actually do to completely destroy an infrastructure that nobody knows how to handle, right? MarTech, we go big. We got agencies and vendors. We make the biggest, broadest infrastructure ever. And then we figure out, how to keep it barely alive and deliver value some way that keeps us alive. So that's the biggest difference in our core backgrounds there. But I think that there's value to marketing, which I would have never said this 10 years ago. I think there's value to marketing when it's done as a balance between a strategic and tactical. I think there's no value to marketing when it's just do it as tactical or strategic without worrying about anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like I should, defend the challenge of marketers a bit here because, again, the customer, by the time someone is in customer service and customer success, there's a relatively well-defined box. They're a customer. Marketing has this challenge of trying to bring new people into the organization. And I mean, that's always been their responsibility. That's not a big, it's a big deal, but that isn't what's changing. The challenge has been the variety of touch points and the evolution of the expectations, of prospects along the way. I mean, it is hard to keep up with. I mean, you were just saying this right now. If you weren't in, one of the reasons an agency can't keep up, often with marketers, it's because if they come up with a framework, things keep changing so rapidly that framework, if it isn't evolving more rapidly, it gets lost. That sort of environment where the pace of change, not even necessarily in the MarTech itself, but the channels, the touch points, the expectations, that just feels like that changes at such a crazy rate that I think it's a very broad span and it's Absolutely. Very hard for people to keep track of all of those things.
By the way, you said something that is the core of the second part of the show, which is, you said we can define and we know who a customer is. And I would challenge that, because when it goes down to like data terms, not a single organization can define in data terms who the customer is or what a customer is. And I know this because I've been on so many boards and C-level and executive leadership teams where they say, oh, we know who our customer is. I said, great, show me in your data who your customer is. And they go like, what do you mean in the data? I said, don't tell me who your customer is. Show me where's the data that defines who your customer. And it goes nuts from there. It goes way, 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 way faster than you think downhill. And then they know what the problem is. The problem is not defining who the customer is. The problem is like, what data do you have to define and manage the customer? And that's one of the problems that we have for the AI, you know, evolution. But that's for a later part of the show. I agree with you that you know, there's a huge challenge and it needs to be overcome. I don't agree that a technology is the solution yet. You know, a little bit from legacy and a little bit from clouded thinking, marketers decided that if we can give agencies things to do, we can give vendors things to do, and then I don't worry about it as long as I get my numbers. And thus the 10,000 plus vendors grew from that, and thus the agency overpopulation grew from that, and thus the thinking that distributed work is great, which I totally agree, it is great. But it needs to be managed differently. And I think that's the biggest challenge that marketing is facing today, is how to manage the distributed workload.
I do agree with that. And that kind of goes to what I was thinking about earlier here, just like, again, the operational responsibilities of marketing have just grown. And historically, this has not been a department that's had the capabilities or had to have the responsibilities of operations at that scale. The thing about the explosion in the number of vendors, and I really do find this very interesting, it may have been the case that MarTech was maybe the first place we saw this, or maybe it was just because that was the first place we did this crazy landscape. But I mean, this is across all of these categories, right? I mean, like hundreds of thousands of SaaS. I mean, like MarTech like is small compared to, I don't know what people call FinTech these days. But oh my goodness, like the range of like software solutions out in fintech is insane. Now you might say like, okay, that's broken for a whole bunch of reasons too. But I'm like, if something is broken about this explosion in the number of software apps, I don't think it's something that's unique to marketing at this point.
Actually, yeah. It's funny you said that, because when I first joined Gartner, I came to cover customer service. And my first report for Gartner was called e-service, which was an electronic version of customer service. In 2000, we didn't have online for the most part. It was just barely beginning, and not for the enterprise. So we called it e-service, anybody who do like things like email and chat whatsoever, right? And my first report for Gartner was like, e-service will be decimated over the next 2 years. And that's what actually brought me a lot of notoriety, because as opposed to promoting so many vendors, I said, 90% of you won't be here in 2 years. And I was wrong. It was only a year and a half. But you know, same idea. They all disappear, just like you're going to see, hopefully, with MarTech. The difference is, back then, vendors were floppy and tape vendors, right? You buy a floppy or CD or a tape, and you put it in your own premises, and then you run it on premises. Now it runs online, on the web, and it's easy to replace. It's also easy to get new ones. But to your point, it happened before and it will happen again. We start with thousands and thousands of vendors, and we start narrowing down as we focus in what matters. And then we get to the point where we get like, you know, 10% that they survive. That's just the way that any market goes. I'm just the part that MarTech surprises me a lot, and it's because probably was the first one that had the full use of the cloud for distribution and competition. It's like how long it's taken to go from the thousands to the myriad few that are worth it, you know?
Scott, I wanted to give you your own data from your report. So the current total number of solutions in Scott's market map is 13,080. That's a net increase of 18.5%. But wait, there's a really interesting nugget right below the picture, which is generative AI is responsible for at least 73% of the increase. So we might have seen more attrition had we not had this massive sonic boom on the Gen AI side. But anyway, Sky, I just wanted to...
that actually plays into exactly what I was going to say here, which is, you know, and this has always been the challenge of that MarTech landscape, and talking with people about it, is the forces of consolidation absolutely have been happening here for the past 15 years. Like I've seen it, the vendors that have come, they've grown, they either get acquired or they go away. You know, and so if we just like pick the starting point at 2008, you know, and there was a cohort and you narrow, in fact, I've done this, right? If you look at the cohort of who the vendors were in 2008 and how many of them are still around now, you see this massive consolidation. The problem has been like, it's not the outflow. The outflow is actually working the way people would normally expect rational markets to work. The problem is like the inflow just hasn't ceased, you know? And I know we've been saying like, okay, well, this will be the year that it will cease. But we've been saying it's going to be the year it's going to cease for like over a decade now. And so maybe this is the year where it ceases. I can't predict, but dude, it hasn't yet.
Anybody with an idea, a weekend and an Amazon account can become a vendor. You know, why would it cease? You have $5,000 in the bank doing nothing, and you have an Amazon account, and you have three developer friends in a garage. You're a vendor today. In the old days, to get there, you had to go through like years of developing. Now it's just go online, grab a few, you know, grab an Azure or you know, a GCP or even an AWS account, tap into the libraries, put some like things together, even with no code or low code interfaces, and you have something that works, and then you put it out there, and then you refine it over the next 6 months after you get money from VCs, and you're a vendor. Well, there's no point in ceasing because there's an environment that is created for that wasn't available at the turn of the century. And that's one of the huge things that we have, you know, in this industry. You can come up with any idea and go from nothing to a successful vendor. The difference is a lot of these people are overcommitted in their funding obligations, and they're not going to survive past the 4 or 5 year mark because they cannot develop a market big enough to develop and to deliver on their commitments.
So, yes, but here's the thing, and this is where it just gets into like weird territory. The vast majority of the products on that MarTech landscape have taken no institutional capital whatsoever.
I know that's possible now, by the way, which I totally appreciate how that's possible now, because before it was more expensive, but now literally with $25,000 you can run 6 months operation. Yeah. That will get you a market fit and will tell you whether you can make it or not, and then either pivot, recommit, and then go get funding. I totally agree, yeah.
And this is why we've kind of, in some ways, I feel like gone off the map where those dynamics of consolidation, and by the way, I completely agree with you that, boy, there were a set of vendors who raised institutional capital on a set of like anticipated valuations that, for any one of them, you could have had some questions about, but the fact that there were so many of them all vying for the same addressable market, yeah, that is not going to be a pretty situation. And we're probably just starting to come to the window in which that's going to be crazy. But the side of having, yeah, these folks who basically don't take large amounts of institutional capital at crazy valuations, will this be a momentary blip in the world of just like, oh yeah, but we'll try a bunch of this stuff, and then after a few years we'll realize, okay, no, that's not the way to go? Or is this starting to be a shift into what the new normal is, where just everyone creates software, and the scarcity that we used to have around the concept of like software vendors actually instead starts to look a lot more like the world of agencies, service providers, advisors, consultants, where, yeah, there's an infinite number of them. There's different ones of different size. There's different ones who develop different reputations of, you know, great delivery or crappy delivery. But the world of like, oh yeah, there will be 10 software vendors for a category. Are we going to get back to that?
No, and both Craig and I were nodding when he said this is a new normal, because I think we agree on this. It's like, yes, we're entering the world of ecosystems where like Azure, Google, and Amazon, I mean, sorry, Microsoft, Google, and Amazon will own the infrastructure, you know, and platform world for the most part. A few large vendors will become platform providers because they need to. You know, think about my former employer SAP, your current employer HubSpot. Think about, you know, maybe even an Oracle, but potentially a Salesforce, potentially, you know, some of the other ServiceNow, right? And then on top of that, you're going to have like a freaking million things running, like little nuts buzzing all over, providing like very limited value, which, look, if it costs me $100,000 a year to run a company and I make $1 million, dude, I'll do it for the rest of my life without a problem. Seriously. not only will I do it, but I'll do 10 of those. Because once you do one, you can do five easy, and 10 is nothing. I rent a small apartment, a small complex here with, like, you know, 20 offices, get 20 kids out of college to start developing whatever I want. Just, you know, teach them Azure, teach them GCP, AWS if you want to, but no need for that since they're going out of business soon. But, teach them all this shit and then have them come up with ideas and put it into, like, code and then spend $100,000 to run a $1 million business. How bad is that? Seriously, you know?
Yeah, it is the new normal.
The Transaction is presented by Ringmaster, the go-to branded podcast team. You know, when Craig and I were thinking of starting this podcast, we had all the ideas in the world. But you know, all the ideas in the world won't get you a great podcast. That's where Ringmaster comes in. They handle the creative, book guests, and do all the production for the podcast so we can focus on what we do best, talk to one another and our amazing guests. To discover how your company can leverage B2B podcasts to deliver outsized ROI, visit ringmaster.com today.
I think that's part of what's contributing to this is, okay, even if you say the Gen AI co-pilots for development or some of the new Gen AI no-code tools, even if you say, yeah, they're still pretty immature today, it does feel like, okay, that direction is improving and accelerating, and all that is going to do is further contribute. It's going to further lower the barriers to people creating things that are software.
Yeah, I agree with you that it's going to lower the barrier. I think that we need to redefine what software is then, because it cannot be that any guy with an OpenAI account and the ability to produce a GPT would become a vendor. There's no way, or a copilot would become a vendor. There's no way that any company can manage copilots and vendors up the gazoo. You know, we don't need another eye chart of copilots and vendors for, like, how to take the trash out on Tuesday nights versus how to take the trash out on Wednesday nights. You know, it's like, we need value, not just sheer generation. And we're seeing sheer generation right now. We see all these people and all these smart people and vendors that are creating stuff that is non-defensible over the long run. I mean, making a decision on whether it's Tuesday or Wednesday to take out the garbage doesn't require two different avatars or agents working in the background.
No, but see, this is the thing. It's like and again, I really do take the parallel of the world of agencies, service providers, consultants, advisors is, I mean, we don't need the 100,000 plus companies out there who do that, but we have them. And in some ways, while there's a lot of disadvantages to that, one of the advantages, I would argue, of it is an incredibly competitive space. And other things being equal, right, this should be the benefit the buyer, you know, the buyer gets challenges when having to deal with so many choices. I won't disagree with that. But one of the advantages that should accrue to buyers when you have that much competition is they should be able to get to a place where, like, the cost, is a competitive cost. We've seen the opposite in previous decades where when there is so much consolidation in an industry and, you know, a very large vendor gets a significant lock-in, generally that doesn't end well for the buyers. That becomes, a rent extraction exercise.
Yeah, exactly.
So, like, competition is challenging, but I think it probably does more to benefit buyers than it harms them.
So those who know me would be shocked by what I'm going to say, but I was listening to the GM for the 49ers in an interview yesterday, right? And they were asking him about what his thoughts were on, obviously, the Super Bowl, but, like, overall, how the 49ers came on the last 4 years for being, what was it, like 10 and 6, to actually get in the Super Bowl. And he said the key to everything that happens in a football team, and he may be right or wrong, I don't know, because I don't know shit about sports and I never will, but because the key to what happens in a football team comes down to the quarterback. And said, this is the hardest job in the world, because if you're going to see all the pressures that are put in the quarterback, all the expectations and everything, it is a remarkable individual. I said, and there's no way there are 32 of those people in the world available so that every team has a top-level talent. He said, there's only one Mahomes, there's only one Purdy, you know, and that's what you have to understand. I mean, the thing that happens with AI the same. There's no 32 AI experts that can take this to the next level, but there's, like, 100,000 kids running around in Stanford and Berkeley and MIT, creating AI magic or whatever you want to call it, that have ideas that will go somewhere. It's just finding them at homes on the party that will make a difference in AI over the next, you know, couple decades. It's not going to be like, you know, 1, 2, 3, 5 years. It's going to be decades in the making. This is the next, you know, this is going to, like, you know, be the end of my career. I'm going to be talking about AI by the time I'm like rocking in a chair, in a rocking chair in the porch of the nursing home, you know. But you need to find those Mahouts and those party to, like, you know, take it Gen AI or even AI further. You can't just keep looking or working on all these guys that are, like, you know, doing okay but not really getting to the top level. So, and that was a sports metaphor that anyone who knows me is still trying to figure out where did I come up with that from. So just so you know.
Well, for what it's worth, this is apparently something we have a common dimension to, because yes, you already expressed more knowledge of football than I have. So, yeah, kudos.
Yeah, normally you'll see Scott's process start. He's getting ready to say something. On that one, he was like, okay, great.
Like, now I feel a common bond. Like,
so forget football, but let's talk about the reality, which is the same. You need to find those AI people that have truly innovative ways to do it that you want to promote to take this to the next level versus the people that are just doing the job because they got a certain degree of success, but they're not really going to change the way that we do things. And that's what's going to change Gen AI and take it to the next level, right? The 6 to 12 people that are out there that are working on stuff that is really going to be differentiated and innovative in the AI world, you know?
All right. So there's a pattern here, which I think you're right about, but I'm curious, yeah, how people should like approach this, which is what you're describing there sounds actually very similar to where we started, you know, in the discussion about marketers and like, okay, how many marketers out there really truly get, you know, like, hey, I can have this level of the strategy discussion with the board, you know, and the models for that. And I understand what's going to be required to actually operationalize that, you know, and you made the point that you've met relatively few people who you think run that balance. Now, I don't think you're wrong. I think that's a really extraordinary person. And so that same thing here with AI. And so it's almost like, okay, so we're going to be in this world where the distribution curve has these incredibly long tails, or at least maybe it's a skewed, you know, but there's like this really long tail of like, okay, who are the best at this sort of stuff? Yeah. And for the vast majority of everyone else, they're way back here, you know, in some sort of like left skewed distribution. What are those people in that big left skewed distribution? What should they do? How should they be approaching this?
That is a, like, you know, $1 billion question, right? I mean, that's always been the thing. It's like, how do you take something that is highly academic, which AI still remains, and make it commercial available, and make it, like, you know, sellable and able to help the organization. I mean, we did this at the turn of the century with knowledge management and NLPs, right? AI back then was called NLP. I know it sounds shocking, but, you know, that's what it is. I mean, we figured out how to manage language naturally. We figured out how to go from spoken word to like text in a way that could be recognized by computers. I mean, the technology was available. And when we did this, we had the same conversation, the exact same conversation. I had vendors when I was a gardener that were fantastic and they could never make the transfer from academia to commercial, right? Incredible evolutions, but the product was too complex. They couldn't figure out how to tell the story. They couldn't figure out how to go forward. And again, there's an overlap here between marketing and AI. Again, if you make an incredible evolution, like, for example, mixture of experts, right? I mean, we keep talking about the limitations of LLM as a large language model, how to reduce them, how do you actually reduce the cost of tokenization, how do you reduce the cost of operation. Mixture of experts was a great innovation. Mistral is doing some fantastic things there, but few people know about it because they're talking in terms that, like, most people don't really mean. I say tokenization and in a executive leadership meeting, and they go like, I don't know what you're talking about, and I don't care to know what you're talking about, you know. So there's you know, there's a need to transfer the academia to commercial. There's a need to tell a better story, which is where marketing can come in, at least at the strategic level, if not the tactical level, and take over. And there's a need to take those innovations on AI that will make it different and tell the story in a way that people can get behind it. This is what OpenAI did really well. You know, I was actually writing this in response to a friend email last night. What OpenAI did really well, they said, we're not going to have an impact that we want to have in the world if we just focus on a small set. So let's go and take the whole internet. You know, let's tokenize the whole internet and put it in a place that can create responses for everything that existed on the internet in 2021. And let's create a very simple interface to that and let's see what happens. And people go like, oh my God, this is magic. Look at how he knows everything, you know? But it's worthless because nobody needs that much knowledge. I mean, you need reduced model sets. You need the ability to, like, you know, use taxonomies and things like that. But kudos to OpenAI and kudos to Microsoft for realizing the marketing value they could get from investing in them. But there's no value there. There's no solution there. I mean, we're seeing that today, you know. The only value in there is like getting the conversation forward, but the real value that OpenAI... I mean, I wrote a book on OpenAI yesterday with 6 prompts. You know, literally, I have an 18-page book on the value of data that I didn't do anything other than prompt OpenAI had to continue to narrow everything. And then at the end said, write a book with all the questions that I asked before and come up with a title, come up with 3 chapters, come up... Everything formatted. I took it out, put it in a Word document. I have a book on the value of data that I never even, like, you know, worry other than writing 6 prompts. It's garbage. It's absolute garbage. But I promise you that if I were to publish that as a research that I did, people will be shocked at how thorough it is and how much research went into it. And all I did was write 6 stupid prompts, man.
Yeah.
There's no value in that.
Well, okay. So as a writer myself here, I'm not going to push back on... the what is being generated, like the use case of basically using Gen AI to do the writing for us.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people are doing that. There's actually, I think, a lot of use cases where it's acceptable. It doesn't thrill me because I appreciate writing at a different level. Where I genuinely get excited, though, is the other direction. I mean, even these cases, like I know one of the common cases you see in, you know, not just MarTech, but like more like even customer service tech is like, mm-hmm. okay, hey, I need to bring in my manager on, you know, this long open ticket with a particular customer. There's been, you know, dozens of messages back and forth, you know. Now you could have the, you know, rep try and go back and properly summarize all those things in a quick thing. These GPTs are actually pretty good at taking that and like bringing that down to a decent summary. And it's like the same sort of thing where, you know, like folks are trying to do the, you know, you described it as an interface. I think it's a very, like, to me, that's actually the use case that I get most excited about is like, okay, I want to report, you know, yeah. I'm not talking about data science or something super. I'm like, oh, yeah. I just want a report that does X, you know, instead of having to like learn for any given particular tool, what are all the different menu choices and options I get down to that report? If I can just say, I'm looking for a report with this, it actually then generates support, even if it's like ideally not a black box, like it's not just giving me the report, it's showing me the config options too. Yeah. So I know what it is. Like those use cases, I mean, they're not rocket science, but it feels like, okay, this actually is making life a little bit more productive for a broader set of people.
Yeah. I mean, go to your favorite customer database, point your LLM training module to that and say, go through this database and build out, you know, look at all the information and then come back and tell me what are the, like, you know, the 6 priority items that I need to know, you know, the 6 priority labels that you think apply to all this database. Tell me how you would cross-tab that to, like, you know, my strategic growth initiatives, which are the following, and then tell me what the data is. And literally in 20 minutes with a few prompts that like narrow bound and like, you know, they digress this in different versions, you will have the report that you need to provide to the board that tells you exactly what's in your database and even growth strategies, if you want, that take the information in there and tell you what you can actually pounce on. That's analytics. We've been doing this forever. The difference is the interface, which is, you know, Gen AI or a GPT, which is great. It's a fantastic thing. Like you said, low code, no code, you know, GPTs, Gen AI, you know, these interfaces are fantastic. This is the way we democratize access to data, which is what we need to move AI forward. I have no qualms on that. I have a qualm when you tell me that, like, you know, the stupid ChatGPT is AI and the future of the world, where if you ask a question, it will give you an answer that is so canned and so prepared 10 years ago that it has no value. That's my problem with the way it's being used, right? So yeah. Yes, it's an interface, and it's a fantastic interface. And anything that lets people that don't understand how to go through, you know, come up with a model, is incredibly good. And if you know what your job is, and if you know the data you're looking for, and you understand how to like interface with the machine, you can get an incredible amount of value in charts and reports and you know, tables and whatnot. And you can cut and paste into Excel, and you have like, you know, the rest of your life worked out, and that's fine. But it's an interface. You know, that's the bottom line.
All right. Well, that is at least one part of the Venn diagram where you and I are aligned.
Esteban, when you described for someone in with years of watching ops, rev ops, marketing ops, is hugely valuable.
It is. I don't disagree. Yeah. Do you remember when Salesforce did the Einstein, I think it was like 5-6 years ago, the bobblehead, and they did the natural language interface to ask for reports, which is basically what Gen AI can do, that where you could actually say, show me the revenue broken down by regions and quarters, and point out to me the top three, you know, potential opportunities based on growth in other areas. And then Einstein, you know, hologram bobblehead would be like, of course, you know, and then it would like produce a report and give you the report in like, you know, printed format for you to look at. That was a precursor to this stuff. And there's huge value in this. I mean, how many RevOps leaders do you know that they have no idea what are the potential markets based on like the growth in other areas, right? They don't have the ability to go and look at the growth here, the growth there, then compare the regions. But you give me a spreadsheet that has everything put together, and the data keeps updating weekly or monthly or whenever, and I can run my entire career on this spreadsheet without making many changes to it. I don't disagree that there's value to that.
Yeah. Because, like, you know, something Scott and I talked about, and I talk about all the time is, and by the way, there's still a label on my classes, I just noticed, is, you know, for rev, like, for, I'm just thinking about Scott, not marketing ops, and I know they're in pain too, but like for them to do any kind of analysis today can be, if it's outside of what we've sort of set up to look at in the analytics, can be really painful just because of all the different data sources, et cetera. So for me, like when you were describing, that was huge. That's huge for a lot of, we can make a rev ops and marketing ops even more strategic than they have been in the past, just from what you described.
So here's a challenge / value proposition for any vendor that produces data today. Make it easy to be accessible by a processor, by a GPT or any processor. Make it easy and available to be accessible by any ecosystem. You do that, and you got 90% of the world in and out of your hand without a question. Seriously. It doesn't matter who you are. The 13,800 plus vendors that you have in MarTech, make it easy. Don't make it like, oh, no, my database is very complicated. You'll never understand anything. You're going to define a customer. Define a customer in a way that is easy. Use metadata so that the companies that buy your product can actually merge your metadata with their metadata and have like one common definition of a customer. So when I go and ask the CEO, show me the data that defines your customers, they don't go like, well, you know, I think we have 6 customers if you define it that way. I say, no, you have 18 customers if you define it that way, because they have 18 different products. Use metadata. I mean, like, create an ecosystem. Use metadata. All these things are, you know, I love these interfaces, but I also think that the more work to be done in the background is going to be the most important part of it.
Yeah. Well, man, I feel like you and I are like, the Venn diagram overlap keeps getting more and more. Like, I completely agree on this thing of this has been... It's interesting. We approached this from originally the challenge of just integration more broadly, where it was more of these like point-to-point integrations between different products in the MarTech stack. And at the end of the day, it's like, listen, you need to treat integration as a first-class capability, because if people can't integrate this stuff with the rest of their stack, they're not going to get the value out of you. And what's exciting to me is like, I mean, there is still a long way to go. I mean, I'd like to think vendors are making more progress in APIs than they have been for a while, but there's still a long road to go. That being said, what's exciting about the Gen AI stuff, and then even at some of this level of like where you see people, you know, having more bi-directional ways of just sharing their data to things like a, you know, data warehouse or whatnot, you know, again, we could argue about the pros and cons of the data warehouse architectures, but the reality of saying like, listen, I need everything that's in my stack to be able to get data in and data out. You know, I don't want this stuff like siloed or black boxed. And I want to make sure that I have APIs that open up so that if someone wants to be able to like access some capability, you know, in my product, I can do that with an API. And before it was like, well, who's going to take advantage of that? You know, a developer. Okay, fine. But it's now with things like these LLMs and some of these like no code automation tools and whatnot, where those things, like they can have the nicer interface to the end user of like, yes, present me with, you know, a nice prompt environment. And then they translate that down into executing those API calls. I mean, again, I'm doing a lot of this. This is very hand wavy, but it's like, it feels like that's a direction where, okay, we could actually really improve how all this software works together.
It's there was a concept that we use in knowledge called, at least that I use, I don't know if anybody else did, but I don't care because I am the market anyways. But there's a concept in the knowledge management that we use called knowledge in storage versus knowledge in use, right? And we spend all our time and resources in creating knowledge in storage. We capture the data, we index it, we put it in the right place, we made it accessible. But it's store. It doesn't do anything, right? And the same, we're doing the same thing with data. We have data in storage, and we don't have data in use. I think those interfaces are starting to provide the entry-level part of what data in use becomes. There's a million freaking challenges, you know, stemming from that. But man, if we get to use the data that we're storing at some point, what was it? Somebody said that we create like 5 petabytes of data every single day. You know, if you consider all the noise and everything created, I need to go and find the right thing and extract value. But man, if you were to like find a way to use that, I mean, first narrow it down, bound it, and then use it. And this is where like, you know, the processors do a good job. They take all the data and then they find the common components and then they cut through the noise, they find the signal, and then they provide you the signal. What you do with it is still your problem, not the computer's problem, but at least you have a much more clear signal. You have a lot more wheat and a lot less chaff or whatever it's called. You know, I'm not good at like agriculture either, by the way.
All right, well, I'm going to cite you on the data and storage versus data and use because
I'll send you a report that I wrote. I wrote a report on the knowledge and storage versus knowledge and use, and I could literally go and do a global search and replace the knowledge and data and publish it to them. People would be like, oh my God, this is exactly the problem. But that's because it's all data. Knowledge was, you know, an overly structured form of data. It's all data. At the end of the day, everything is digital. This is what we all undergo in the post-digital world, in a digital revolution world. It's all data. It's all ones and zeros. That's it. Once you understand the computers that make decisions that are one and zero decisions, so based on one and zeros that are stored, the world is a lot simpler to go through. You know, then it's just go play poker. It's like, you know, whatever.
We're hitting the buzzer here on timing. So this was amazing, you guys. But before we go, Scott was drinking a liquid death. I don't know if you guys heard about this. I was drinking one earlier. I don't have it. I mean, I don't know if you guys saw this, but Liquid Death is auctioning off on eBay the opportunity to have a company's ad on 500,000 cases of Liquid Death distributed throughout the country. So I thought, Scott, I'd let you know, and you could go tell Kip that he can go on eBay.
This will be incredibly hard to game that these days with the existence of bots everywhere for everything.
We'll see the final price. When the tweet came out, it was like 61,000. That thing's going to be huge by that, you know, with the bots, etc. So anyway, okay, great. So guys, awesome. It's fun to watch, you know, two of the smartest people I know just sort of have this conversation. And I'm sure it would be for the audience as well. It's incredibly enjoyable. So I just want to thank you guys for doing this. And we will do it again sometime. We will do this again sometime when the next big news comes out. We'll come on and bring you guys on for your take. So thanks, guys. And thank you, everyone.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Transaction. Craig and I really appreciate the fact that you've listened all the way to the end. What are you actually doing here? For show notes and other episodes, please visit us at thetransactionpod.com, like and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any other place you get your podcast from. The Transaction is sponsored and produced by Ringmaster, the go-to branded podcast team. To discover how your company can leverage B2B podcasts to deliver outsized ROI, visit ringmaster.com now. Either you have walked away from your podcast device, or this is playing somewhere in the background. Someone in your house would really like for you to shut this off now.